Hi friends, this is Dr. Michael Williams, and welcome back to another episode of the Diversifying Path podcast. This podcast explores how investing in diversity can lead to a high return of investment in pathology and laboratory medicine by learning from the knowledge and experiences of diverse voices within our field. My next guest is Dr. Dan Tyrell. Dr. Tyrell earned his bachelor's degree in kinesiology at the University of Michigan and received his PhD in integrated physiology and pharmacology from Wake Forest School of Medicine in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, before completing postdoctoral training as a research fellow in the University of Michigan's Department of Cardiology. Dr. Tyrell was recruited to the University of Alabama at Birmingham, the Division of Molecular and Cellular Pathology, and started his research lab in August 2022. The Tyrell Lab uses molecular biology, immunology, and genetic approaches, including single-cell RNA sequencing, flow cytometry, and imaging to understand how neurodegeneration and cardiovascular diseases occur during aging. In the summer of 2020, during his postdoctoral fellowship, Dr. Tyrell coordinated with a group through Twitter and helped co-founded the organization called Black and Cardio. Through Black and Cardio, Dan has helped organize annual week-long virtual events and partnered with organizations including the American Heart Association, the American Association of the Advancement of Science, and British Heart Foundation. Black and Cardio has been featured in Forbes, Nature Medicine, and BMC on Medicine blog, and Dan, along with the other co-founders of Black and Cardio, recently wrote a commentary, which was published in Nature Reviews Cardiology, to discuss the work and future goals of Black and Cardio. Dan recently helped file to transform the Black and Cardio movement into a non-for-profit corporation, and is currently helping to plan a third annual Black and Cardio Week, along with the rest of the organizing team. Without further ado, it's Dr. Dan Tyrell. All right. Hi again, friends. This is Dr. Michael Williams. I'm here with another episode of the Diversify Path podcast. So I'm here with my next guest. Can you tell us who you are, where you are from, and your pronouns?
Yeah, I'm Dan Tyrell. He, him are my pronouns, and I'm from a small town in Michigan called Milan. It's south of Ann Arbor, so it's pretty close to Ann Arbor and the University of Michigan.
Okay. And then can you tell us what level of career you're in right now?
Yeah, I just started at UAB, actually, University of Alabama at Birmingham, as an assistant professor in August. Before that, I was a postdoc, and before that in grad school, and then before that, that's ancient history.
Well, so on the podcast, I always try to explore the ancient history, kind of delve in people's past. So let's start from where you feel comfortable doing, but let's start with like your journey to getting a PhD. What inspired you to go that route? What inspired you to go into STEM?
I think I always was interested in science. For me, it wasn't like I always wanted to go into research. I actually did an undergrad at the University of Michigan. I did a research. It was for credit, but it was like a 6 hours a week or 12 hours a week thing for a whole semester, actually two semesters. And I realized that I hated that research. That wasn't in biomechanics. So it was a lot of engineering and things, and that wasn't my major. So I got one piece of advice from one of the postdocs there. And she said, when it's your research and your project, it's a lot more fun. And it kind of stuck with me. So I sort of had that in the back burner, but I just knew I wanted to do something scientific, but not necessarily science. So something in STEM. And for a while, I thought med school or dental school or something like that. Eventually, I started applying for programs, mostly master's programs. And then I saw how much the tuition was going to cost. So I canceled those plans, took another year off, and then decided to apply directly to PhD programs. Gotcha. Come with a stipend, and you don't, in the US, you don't need a master's degree to do a PhD. I think it's easier to get in with a master's degree, but it just seemed to make more sense.
Gotcha. And during your journey, cause I'm going to go down the STEM rabbit hole for a bit. when you were applying, what were things like you wish you knew when you were applying, things that you felt like could have made the process easier? And obviously it's just because for college students or high school students who are thinking about different careers, like things that maybe they could gain from your journey.
Yeah. So I think I didn't know exactly what to expect. So I had, if I could do it again, I would do a lot of things differently, I think. Mm-hmm. I think it's best just to be organized, but I didn't even know what the process was. So I knew you had to take the GRE and I knew you had to take prerequisites and then submit your application. But I didn't know what to expect during like the interview and the visit and that kind of thing. So my first one actually was at Wake Forest University where I ended up going. So I guess it worked out. but I think during some of the interview, stages, I was just totally lost and I didn't totally take ownership, I guess, of my time in the interviews. I was being led around and kind of shuffled around by one of the current grad students who got me to one of these group interview sessions late. So I think that reflected pretty badly on me, even though I was supposed to be shuffled there by this other person. But I walk in late and I don't think I think they knew that it was sort of this guy's fault, but I should have been more on top of the time as well. So I think those kind of things would have helped. And I didn't know anybody that had a PhD or went to grad school beyond just undergrad. So I didn't really know what I was getting into. So if you can talk to somebody that's been through the process, that would definitely help.
And so again, college and high school students who are thinking about or doing research and that, how did you finally decide the lab that you worked in order to get your doctoral degree?
That's kind of another thing that I really didn't know what to expect. So I knew you're supposed to do these rotations and I kind of had rose-colored glasses on when I went into the process. So I thought any lab would be open and would be available if I was interested, but it really isn't the case. It depends on if they have space for somebody, if they're looking for somebody, and mostly if they have funding for somebody. And so those rotations are really for them to sort of feel you out and you to feel them out. One thing I would say is use the rotations to figure out which labs to not join. I was in a rotation and there was a PI that was very interested in having people join and do rotations. And I found out that this person was always looking for people because nobody liked to be in their lab and it was not a great environment. I got some advice from some current grad students that way that kind of helped. But where I ultimately landed, it was I did one rotation with someone that ended up leaving and moving to a different university, so I couldn't go with them. I did one rotation with someone that was running a core lab, but they didn't have funding really to take on a student. And then I did the last one with someone who had funding, but was in like a statistics department, and I wasn't in a statistics grad program. I was in physiology. But she knew a different lab, and so she kind of shuffled me into this lab, and it ended up working out. I think because I had a pretty good relationship with her, she knew what would have worked well for me, but it really was that kind of mentorship that got me into this other lab, and that's the lab that I did my PhD in. So it was kind of like a translational research lab, which was good because I didn't have like any research skills coming in. So it gave me the chance to kind of learn those things a little bit more slow than just jumping into like a wet lab scenario where I think most of those people had some research experience in a wet lab prior to joining the labs. But yeah, so it's not like I did have an idea of what I wanted to do when I went to Wake Forest and then I did something totally different. but I think, and I'm not doing anything really similar anymore even than what I did in grad school. So I think if I had to like give a piece of advice to grad students who aren't like maybe finding a place where they feel like they fit, you just have to get through the program. You're taking classes, you just have to do well in the classes, and you have to do enough to get your PhD. And then when you get it, you can go on and do something different. It's actually encouraged usually to go on and do something a little different.
Okay. So I was going to say that was like an interesting correlate. like in terms of like when you go to any sort of graduate program, like say for my experience in medical school, where it's more like rigid. So you're like, you know, classes, do well classes, and then you do a residency, and it's like rotations, and then fellowship, which is a little more, you're just, you know, specifically for that area that you're studying in. And then afterwards, like, you know, it seems like after you're done, it's like, with all that training and such being scheduled, it's like, okay, what do you do next? And it's kind of just like, wait, where else do I go? Like, how do I do that? But I say that because I agree with like what you were saying earlier, the mentorship aspect, where you're having somebody who sees it and they kind of know how things can work for you or how you can fit into a certain way in order for you to kind of succeed, basically. And so I did kind of like that little correlate. So just to kind of go a bit further, right? And then you defended your thesis. Sorry, defended your dissertation. I'm so sorry, PhD people. I'm so sorry.
It's all the same.
I'm learning. So again, grad students or high school or college students, anybody, or even MD PhDs or DO PhDs, anybody who's pursuing a PhD route in science, you know what? Let me rephrase that. I'm going to go back. You go and, you know, you're a postdoc. Let me say that because I'm like, I'm not saying this. Can you tell us like what that process is like what you've gained during your postdoc years?
Yeah. So a postdoc is, I guess the best way that I can think to like correlate it to a medical progression would be like similar to residency. So you've done all this training and things like that in grad school and taken a lot of classes, and now it's time to just learn some more, but mostly like practice what you've learned and put it into practice. And so it's similar to grad school, but there's no classes. You're a lot more on your own, and you're expected to produce things, whereas in grad school and maybe in med school, it's more like your mentors are putting things into you for you to learn and get trained up. And now that you're trained, they want you to use that training. So postdocs, I think typically people advise you to do a postdoc in something in a different area from what you were doing for grad school, because you already have those skills. So learn a different skill set. So for me, in grad school, I was doing a lot of things with patient blood and basically taking blood from patients that were in clinical trials and then doing things with the blood in the lab. But for my postdoc, I joined a lab that does a lot of mouse models of disease and really like wet bench lab type of research. And so for that, I learned a lot about mouse genetics and breeding. Mice and what you do with the tissues and things like that. And you can do a lot more with the mouth that you can't do obviously with people. So it kind of opened up a different avenue for me. And that was just my experience. But a lot of people will take their postdoc opportunities and maybe go join the lab of some famous scientist or a big lab somewhere in Boston or LA or something like that. I don't think you necessarily have to do that. You can join a lab that's, for me, I weighed whether or not I wanted to be near my family, which was in Michigan, or join a lab that was doing more like cutting edge things. And ultimately I got kind of the best of both worlds. So I joined a lab that I had never heard of, but that was pretty well known, at least in their little niche that had just moved to Michigan. So it was close to my family and my wife's family. And also happen to be doing things that I was really interested in learning. But postdocs usually there, I mean, it's not as rigid, I think, as residency. So postdocs can be any amount of years that you want them to be. Some people will do two postdocs, but usually those would be shorter. It's like 3 years and 3 years. I did one postdoc that ended up being 6 years. It's a lot of it is just depending on what you want to do after. So I wanted to start a lab. So I needed to get papers and grants and things like that. If you just want to get some more experience before going to find a job, like at a pharmaceutical company or something like that, you wouldn't have to necessarily focus on getting as many papers or grants and things like that. Yeah, so you could do a lot with a postdoc, but it is a lot. It's you have a lot more time to do actual research.
Right.
Because in grad school, it's like you want to do things, but you're in classes and you have to focus on that. So you have a lot less time. Maybe a senior grad student has more time, like the fourth year, fifth year grad students. But
Can you tell us, I guess I'll kind of stop these baited questions. At least I'm like digging into your whole life story. What was
that's
like,
all right.
It was like transitioning from a postdoc into an to an academic faculty with your own lab. Like what that experience is like. Just let's say there is a postdoc out there listening to this and just like wondering what it's like. What was your experience like?
That's about the most jarring experience that I've had in my life, I think.
I didn't mean to laugh at your pain.
No, it's a really weird transition because all of a sudden, like one day you're a trainee, you're like junior. I mean, you're like the most, I don't know, highly trained and educated trainee like in the world after, I don't know, like I was 30, I'm 34 now. So I was like 34 years old and I'm still like considered early career and I have friends like global, I don't know, COO of development of whatever company. And then I'm still like a trainee. And then the next moment, now you're an assistant professor, you're faculty. And I don't know, all these doors are kind of opened. You can go to these faculty meetings that are, you're not invited to as a postdoc and do all these other things. But the jarring part is that you're not trained for most of what you do now. So you're running almost a small business in your laboratory. So you're hiring people. I've never been trained out how to like interview people or go through the HR process, how to pay people and all these types of things. So you do rely a lot on the department and the staff that they have to do that. And they do handle most of those things, but it is kind of a weird experience. So you also have to do a lot of just administrative things that you'd never really think of as a postdoc, like writing an animal care and use protocol and all these other like health and safety protocols, mostly for working with nucleic acids and other things that you do in the lab. But as a postdoc, that's all handled by someone else typically. So it's kind of weird to go to that, but it is really nice. I mean, like I have this lab at UAB and I can, for the most part, just go do any like harebrained idea that I have within reason. Whereas as a postdoc, you're using someone else's money typically. So you kind of have to be more careful and do what they want you to do depending on how much leeway they give you. But it's all dependent on who you work for. And all of a sudden you don't work for anybody really, except for, I guess, I mean, there are like department chairs and things, but they're never coming to the lab and saying, "What are you doing?" getting grants and papers and things like that. They don't care. Typically.
Right.
So
you're like, he's productive. The lab is productive, I should say.
Yeah.
I'm going to say share a small antidote because it's me and Dan, we find each other in grad rounds, and afterwards, Dan's like, I don't know where things are at quite yet because he's still, well, at the time of this recording, he's still trying to figure out things at UAB. And I'm like, it took me 2 months to kind of figure out some of this stuff. I mean, I haven't been to everywhere yet, but I'm like, at least we know where the coffee place is at. So that's just a good thing.
right.
So I wanted to take this to transition into something that you worked as a part of, and that's the on Twitter, the Black and Cardio. And I was wondering if you could, one, let people tell people what the Black and Cardio is and like how you got involved with it. And
So Black and Cardio is, I guess categorize it as like a grassroots movement or organization. Mostly, I mean, we have three goals, but mostly it's to increase visibility of Black people in the cardiovascular field. And it's not just a research based thing. So nurses, like social workers, physicians, and also research. And then we also have kind of an added goal of destigmatizing cardiovascular medicine and research in the Black community, because there is, I think, a stigma in a lot of Black communities, rightly so, about being participants in research studies and things like that. So I got involved on Twitter, obviously. Mm-hmm. Most of our activities take place on Twitter. But it was in 2020 in the summer, I think August maybe or July. And a lot of other Black in cardio or Black in STEM groups were forming. Mostly it was after the George Floyd killing, and the first group was this Black Birders group. So bird watching enthusiasts got together and had a Black Birders Week, which was, I like birds. It was, I liked it a lot. It was really fun. I learned a lot. And then all these other STEM, more like STEM research based groups kind of popped up. So there's a Black in Chem, which is chemistry, Black in Neuro, which is neuroscience, geoscience, geology, astrophysics, everything. I mean, there's tons of them. And so we started one that was Black in cardio. And my involvement, it was really, someone said, "Where's Black in Cardio?" on Twitter, because all these other groups were popping up. And I think I just retweeted it. And then the guy who sent that tweet sent me a DM and just said, "Do you want to get involved?" And so I said, sure. And then we started it, and that was it. So we had like a Zoom meeting a couple weeks later, and there's eight or nine kind of co-organizers. Mostly we're kind of split half and half in England and then in the US. So my involvement has been a little bit, I think, unique. So I'm the only white person of the organizers. And I've been doing things that are kind of a little bit more behind the scenes. So we have like a week of events each year. So an annual week of events. And typically it's just either an interview on Zoom or YouTube, streaming on YouTube, and we record all these. Or it's like a scientific talk or session, something like that. But they're all just online, so anybody can come. So I haven't hosted any of those. I think it's better. I kind of feel like it's better for my Black colleagues to have the exposure of doing the interviews. And to be honest, I don't think the interviews themselves are, it's like a chat kind of like this. So, and we don't edit anything. So we don't do much work other than record it and put it on YouTube. Gotcha. So they can have that kind of exposure. And we only invite Black people to kind of share their perspectives or share their research. So the things that I've been doing for Black in Cardio are, like, I made the website. I don't know if it's a good website or not, but I made it, kind of maintain it. I did start the Twitter just because I was worried someone was going to scoop us and, like, take the handle. But now other people kind of do those things. And then this has nothing to do with being white or Black or anything, but I happen to be the only U.S. citizen. So the people in the U.S., that are involved are on visas. And so they don't want to be affiliated with like the monetary financial stuff. So I submitted the paperwork and everything to form our nonprofit, which was kind of weird. Yeah. So I'm like the director of our nonprofit, which feels kind of weird. There's two other people listed on the like filing documents, but they're in England. So it's kind of weird. My home address is our business address. But, it's kind of a weird feeling. It is what it is. And so I think the only reason we did that was because we want to pay all the speakers. So we feel very strongly that if we're going to invite you to come and talk about like trauma or difficulties or racism and things like that you deal with, you really should be compensated for that time. And so the first year when we weren't a nonprofit, we had all these people, and we had people pledged to give us a lot of money, like several thousand dollars. And it was enough to pay these speakers, like 20 or 30 speakers, like a couple $100 honorarium. But we had no place to take the money. Like, they can't just, like, some of our donors, and these are all on our website, it's not private information, but like Stanford and the University of Michigan and a lot of other places were going to give us money, and
right.
like you can't just send a check to me and to your I'm going to do it to get into some tax problems that way. So we had to finagle like all these donors, like writing the checks directly to the speakers mm-hmm. and things like that. It was really a headache. So after we're a nonprofit, now we can have a business account, bank account, tax exempt and all that stuff. And so we can accept donations, and now it's really a lot easier to pay our speakers their honoraria mm-hmm. and pay the, I don't know, $50 for our domain name each year and things like that. We don't have a lot of expenses, but, and we don't have a lot of money either, to be honest, but we have enough to pay our speakers and that kind of thing. So that's been nice. I've never been paid to give a talk anywhere. So I feel like we're doing something different, which the speakers, they don't always accept the money, but we always offer mm-hmm. it, and the ones that do accept it are grateful. And I think a lot of times, I mean, a lot of our speakers are postdocs and grad students, and to get paid a couple $100 for a, mm-hmm. like a 1 hour session, it's like scientific session or discussion. I think it's for them, I think it's surprising. They don't always right. expect it, but probably hopefully appreciate it as well.
That is so awesome. Like, I'm so glad you were able to share that on this platform, even though I think mostly I always say pathologist, laboratory medicine, but whoever's listening could like hear and, you know, see how like things coming from Twitter or like how an idea forms and like how it grows and evolves. The question I have for you is, are there things that you felt like you've learned from your experiences, in hearing your stories, things that you may not have heard of or experiences that you were, that made you think differently about like how, like let's say Black scientists or Black grad students or Black PhDs or postdocs are, their experiences in approaching their field? Like, was there anything that you felt like you've learned along the way?
Yeah. Definitely. So when I was in grad school, I didn't even consider that people might, because everybody looked like me for the most part. Mm-hmm. But I never had really considered that it could be another way. And I just didn't really take the time to look at that from a different perspective. So from that, it's really eye opening. And especially from the, our organizers that are in the UK, it's really interesting. We were looking for speakers for like Black lab leaders or PIs, and there's like just a couple in all of the UK. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And one of our co-organizers is in the lab run by a Black PI, and that's just like it's so rare, which mm-hmm. is just really kind of eye-opening. I think it's maybe not so stark in the US. There are more Black people, I think, than in these positions, but it's still not. I mean, it's still a really, really low number. And so it really is true. Like if you're in grad school and you're Black, then you might be the only Black person in your lab. You might be the only Black person in your program. Even in like my program in grad school only had 4 people each year. But some of the other programs were much larger, but still there was very, very few people of color and especially people that are Black. So it definitely can feel isolating, and it's something that I don't experience or can't really even wrap my head around fully, but I can imagine it's just a lot more difficult to go through grad school that way. And especially because usually when you go to grad school, it's not like in your home city, so you're not even near your family in most cases as well. So if you don't have that support, it's kind of a difficult thing to go through. So that kind of to me is one of the most eye-opening parts of it. The other thing is that I thought for a long time during grad school and as a postdoc even, that I would, once I become a faculty member or if I can get like a tenure track faculty job, then I'll be able to like join these diversity committees or DEI committees and make some kind of impact. But it occurred to me that in the summer of 2020, when who knows what was going on in the world, everything was kind of chaos, it felt like, but it occurred to me then that I didn't have to wait till I'm in this position of power to do something.
Right.
And it might have been difficult to do something really on my own, but to join one of these groups and participate in a lot of ways, you don't have to wait, and you don't have to do a lot of things on your own. And to be honest, so working with Black and Cardio takes a lot of time, like in the months or weeks leading up to our weekly or annual week of events. But most of the year, it's not all that much work. And I do feel like it's probably more impactful as far as DEI work than anything else that I've ever done. And I joined, like, when I was a postdoc, I joined like the postdoc association and joined the subcommittee on anti-racism and things. But it just, the work never felt very meaningful. It was like, we're doing education things and here, read this article and we'll put these links on a website, and it's not, you're not really doing much. That's where I think these like Black and Cardio, Black and Neuro, and all these other STEM groups, they're really like grassroots efforts run by primarily trainees. I mean, I was a trainee when it started, and some of the other members are kind of moving through the ranks as well. And we're still involved, but I think these bottom up approaches are really in response kind of to the top down approaches, not satisfying a lot of people. Not to say that these committees formed at the higher levels of like departmental levels and things aren't useful. It's just, I think if you can't see like a tangible result of those committees, then you still have a lot of like trainees, especially, that feel kind of left out or not supported and these kinds of things. So I think it's good to have both. But I think for a while we didn't have as much of a bottom up approach. A lot of it was like, how can we get the trainees involved in our top down approach?
I love that perspective. Thank you for sharing that. I think there's a lot of stuff, especially that you said, I think that correlates, or a lot of people can vibe with, or can vibe with, especially like, let's say the aspect of advocacy, especially in committees. And that, nothing specifically, but I think with the death of George Floyd, I think when those who are able to actually see what happened for those 8 minutes and 40 something seconds that happened, I mean, I personally couldn't watch it because I was just traumatized in that aspect. But when that happened, I think that the aspect of DEI became, or diversity or racism became such a, I guess, view that people were seeing. And at times it felt like it was gonna, like, I don't know, I guess with each generation, it always feels like there's some little hope, like we're gonna finally have a way to focus on this. And so, you know, racism was cleared a public health issue. And I was telling a friend, like, that even though, like, for me, I knew this was a thing, you know, like, let's go back into medical school where we learn about disease processes and like how, you know, blacks or those of people of color have a 2 to 3 times higher risk of like having hypertension or cardiovascular disease. And it was just like, because they're black. And I was like, that's not it. That's not, you know, there's no ethnicity thing that's happening. It's basically a socioeconomic aspect. It's of, you know, there's a lot of stuff behind that. It's not just big, simply your dark color of your skin. But if I can go back to what I was saying, but I think when we talk about, if I can go back to talk about advocacy, when we talk about advocacy and we talk about what we can do, I think when we see things that were being formed, it was, I think it was a first step, but I think then it became more on, not more on, but more of people who were like, wanted to do more grassroots things, like we're seeing Black and Cardio, but also people who really just, had their passion for advocacy inspired to do something new and different that hasn't been done before, or feel like things that they've seen that doesn't really work and wanted to try to do something different on their own with their own time, power, energy, which really has, I think, transformed some places, even though we don't really see them as much, but I'm pretty sure it has really transformed the way that trainees feel like they have power in order to advocate, and they have power in their agency in order to try to make changes that haven't felt like been seen in the past.
And so I really did like appreciate that. I think the point we wrote up about people feeling like they are, you know, one of many, like another conversation I always had, like, I went to a conference and one of the speakers, it was a DEI session. One of the speakers was Black. And one of the things that he said that really resonated with me as well was just like, he's like, you know, as soon as I came in this room, regardless of what we're talking about, the first thing you seen was I was Black. The second thing is that, you know, subconsciously, either you know it or you don't know it, but you were basically fighting off or probably having implicit bias on your end about me just because you seen me coming in as a Black person. And for me, it was just very powerful because I was just like, oh, yeah, like you know, this is not against anybody, but like growing up and especially, you know, going through a professional field where it's just like you're one of few and the stereotypes and implicit biases or aggressions that occur where you're constantly fighting as often aren't just to get through. It's just like, wow, like, okay, how do I code switch in order to make the other people feel more comfortable than me feeling more comfortable, you know? Like, how does that, it affects the training. And so I just think it's very powerful that you've had people who are able to, or you're part of something that people are able to share stories in a safe space in order to, like, I guess, move the field in a much more positive way in general. And that's basically the end of me blabbering for a bit. Go ahead, sorry.
No, that's perfect. That's kind of what we're trying to do is, I mean, we connect a lot of people on Twitter and try to promote like jobs and things like that, they're not jobs specifically for like DEI or anything like that. But if we promote it, then the people that follow us, they're going to see it. And it's not only Black people that follow our account and things like that, but I say it is weighted that direction. So from that perspective, I think it can be useful. And also, you know, every year we have the symposium essentially where we're inviting, the first year we invited people mostly to talk about issues like DEI issues. So a lot of these roundtables, but then the second year we kind of figured, well, we did the DEI issues last year. Let's just invite Black people that are scientists and tell us about their science. It just has nothing to do with being Black. It's just we're only inviting Black people, and that's a kind of symposium I think that you're never going to get really at an academic institution. They're not going to have like a whole week of events only featuring Black speakers. So from that perspective, it's kind of useful and provides a safer place to present work. And I think it does help trainees. I don't know if you can put it on your CV or something that probably you could. But I think it can be useful. But also showing like students, you're not alone. Even if you are the only person at your institution, there's all these other people at other institutions. And so we've done kind of the online thing, but other groups and we pay the speakers. And so that's kind of our little way to help, I think. But some of the other groups like Black and Neuro and I think Black and Cancer that are a little bit bigger than us. And I don't know, maybe there are more neuroscientists in the world or something like cardiovascular research, but like I think they've put on like actual in-person conferences and given scholarships and things like that. So I'd like to think that, you know, we could keep those types of things going and keep doing our annual event, but I think it's still not enough. But I think it is kind of nice, I think, to have that top-down approach and the bottom-up approach, because there are a lot of places like academic institutions that have money and don't know and want to help DEI issues, but don't know exactly what to do other than having like a DEI session where you invite a Black person to talk about DEI issues, and they probably may or may not be compensated for that. And it puts an extra burden on Black people to basically do the work of educating everyone else. And so I guess from our perspective, we're this organization that I guess now we have enough credibility to convince some of these larger organizations and even companies to give us their money and we'll distribute it to our speakers and things like that at a session that you really would never have.
These
scientific conferences and things like that. So that's been good. And we've also been able to partner with like our bottom-up approach to partner with the top-down approach with some bigger organizations like the American Heart Association and things like that. So it's been useful from that perspective. I will say that sometimes there's strings attached to partnering with some of those organizations, but we haven't had any bad experiences yet, just some, maybe some a little difficult things. but in general, it's been helpful, I think, for us, and I think helpful for these other organizations in achieving their DEI goals as well. So
the question for me to you is, like, what do you think, what is your definition of allyship?
Yeah, I think even my own interpretation of allyship probably is constantly changing. Because I think I used to think that allyship, naively, was just don't be racist. Which you're not, if you're not being part of the problem, then that's a good thing. And it is a good thing, obviously, don't be racist, but it's just, it's not enough. Now I wouldn't classify you, I guess, as an ally necessarily if you're doing just the bare minimum, which is just not doing racist things. So now I think it's a little bit, you have to be doing something active. That's more or less how I interpret allyship. And for me, I want to do it. So like I'm excited about doing this, like working with Black and Cardio, and not only limited to that, but doing other things. And I think you have to be an active participant, and but doing things that are actually improving the situation that we have,
right?
In whatever like little area that you're doing it in, and I, for better or worse, have chosen to do it mostly in the cardiovascular realm, and that's where I put my efforts. But it could very easily be in a different group or different areas and things like that. So I do try to the tangible things that I try to do is just try to make things a little bit easier on my 7 or 8 other Black co-organizers for Black and Cardio. So like maintaining the website, I handle the finances, like send out the checks and do a lot of things on like the unseen parts. And I know they also do a lot of these things as well, but hopefully to alleviate some of the, those types of tasks and, make it a little easier on them. And, you know, in a perfect world, Black and Cardio could be run by like anybody, like half white people, half Black people, or some other makeup, and we'd have a lot more white people doing these types of things. And it's kind of interesting. You know, I was thinking about this actually when I saw your questions. A lot of these organizations like Black and Cardio, Black and Neuro, all these other like grassroots organizations that are fairly new, are primarily run by younger people and trainees, but mostly I think Black people or people that identify in the group that it's designed for. Whereas in a lot of these DEI committees at the institutional level that are like formed based on a decision from top-down approaches, it's a lot more common to have more white people and non-minority people involved. And it's kind of weird because I've some people even that know I'm involved in Black and Cardio have even asked me, are you Black? And when I say no, I'm not, I'm white, they kind of look at me like, well, why are you in the group? And I don't know, it's a weird kind of thing to hear, because it's maybe I probably would have thought that way maybe, I don't know, 5 years ago or something, but now it's like, well, there's a lot of work to do in DEI, and why should only Black people do it? You don't expect that on these other committees, so why do you expect that on these also these grassroots kind of efforts?
I think we have been progressing. I think there has been more of a substantial growth. I think there's a lot of people, like you were saying, trainees, those who are like growing up during this time training and like seeing ways things could be done differently in order for us to basically, you know, make it better down the road, regardless. And so I wouldn't say I agree with that. So I have two last questions. And the first question is about diversifying. I always say diversifying path because that's the name of the podcast. But I think with this, it's more like in STEM. And so what are ways you think we can diversify in STEM?
I think there's a lot of things you could talk about. So like mm-hmm. people talk about the pipeline, getting more young people interested and also retention and other, I mean, there's a lot of things that I think can be done. And I'm not a proponent of one over the other. I think probably just attack the problem in any way that you can. So I think one thing that we can do is with respect to like maybe gatekeeping or putting barriers up. So things like the GRE and all that stuff, requiring those types of things to get into grad school, I think is a barrier for certain people. And I don't, you know, I don't know the exact details and all the things how to fix these problems, but I think making it easier to get people in, also showing people that if they're a minority, any kind of minority, it doesn't have to be black, but that you're not alone, you're supported. A lot of that means there has to be some visible way that you do that, whether or not there's like a grad student association, subcommittee specifically to doing that, or you put on events or do things like that, or you just plug people into like Black and cardio. I mean, it would be very easy for any department if some department out there wanted to say, hey, we want to partner with you. If we are interviewing people and they're Black, can we like give them your information? And we would love that to connect people. And so maybe there's not a lot of Black people in your program, but we can connect you with other Black grad students across the country and even have like a Zoom happy hour or something like that. I mean, there's a lot of things that can be done to show that people are supported. But also the pipeline, I mean, that's an issue. I mean, getting Black high school students and things interested in science. I think some of that, I don't know, that has to be addressed probably at the policy level, and whether or not like you were saying when you went to that conference, if a Black student shows up in a science class, is the science teacher immediately thinking, oh, he's just, we're going to have trouble getting the student even past the class, and they just need to get to this and then graduate. Why couldn't they become a scientist? Why look at them and think, this should be the next PI of well or whatever it is. So I think there's some issues that need to be addressed, and I don't know the best way to address those. But from my perspective, if I'm thinking of like speakers for like the grand rounds to suggest, and I immediately think of someone, do I think, is this a white person? Is this a white man? Should I suggest someone else? And so those are the kinds of things that I personally I'm doing, and trying to make my little impact, whether or not it's having a huge impact or not. But I think if enough people do that kind of thing, then it could have an impact. And I think a lot of that is becoming more visible, especially at like conferences. And there's all these things about like you're invited to a panel, and then they show the lineup of the panel, and it's all white men, and then hopefully all those white men say, actually, I don't want to do this panel anymore. You didn't invite other people of color or anything. And so I think people are being more proactive about that, but it's also still happening. So it's not perfect. And so I think, I do think that things are probably improving. Just hard to quantify that because there's so many groups out there and so many people doing like different things, and hopefully people like thinking about that on their own and not necessarily doing it as part of a group that has quantifiable numbers, but just people behaving and acting differently to improve things. Being an ally, that's what it is, being an ally.
There, full circle.
You don't have to get credit for it. You don't have to put it on your CV. You just have to, that's part of being a person, is just doing good things, so.
And the last question I have is, what are ways people can follow you on social media outlets, see how your career flourishes?
Yeah, so I think I might just move over to LinkedIn for now. Okay. No, I'm just kidding. I'll be on Twitter probably until the website dies. I don't know, for better or worse. It's already getting worse. But so, yeah, Dan, D-A-N-T-Y-R-R, at Twitter, or on Twitter. I'm also You should follow Black in Cardio on Twitter. It's just Black in Cardio. Mm-hmm. That's our handle on Twitter. If you find me, it's in my bio. You can click the link to it. I think I have a link to the website, but I can't remember. But it's there. Okay. I am on LinkedIn, but I don't ever use it. I'm just a Twitter person. I tried Mastodon. Mastodon's just, it's, I don't, nothing bad about it. It's good, but it's just, for me, it's boring.
Okay. All right. I haven't tried it yet.
I don't know why.
Okay. I haven't tried it yet. I was one of the things I might have to do that. But before we're going to have a talk afterwards, is there anything else? Thank you so much for joining. Really appreciate it. Is there anything else that you wanted to tell the listeners before we head off?
No, I can't. This is a great podcast. So not this episode specifically, but in general, this is a great podcast. So thank you for doing what you're doing. It's fun. It's good. I think it's cool.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Are you going to keep doing it? That's maybe offline.
We'll do it offline. Yeah, yeah. No. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And so glad to have you on, basically. Okay. All right. I'm going to stop the recording.
Thanks.
Oh, wait. Okay.
All right.
I'm going to stop the recording right now. I was like.
Hi again, friends. Well, this is it for today's episode. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy day to listen to the Diversifying Math Podcast. Hope you enjoyed the episode, and I hope to see you soon.